Hello and welcome to the July episode of the Our Science podcast, bringing you the latest highlights from around the Royal Society. I'm Emma Woods.
And I'm Katrina Ross.
Outstanding scientists, including pioneers in molecular biology, biomedicine and solar cell technology, make up the 50 new fellows and 10 new foreign members announced by the Royal Society back in May. This month, the new fellows visited the Society to be inducted into the fellowship and to talk about their work.
Dame Sally Davis, Chief Medical Officer for England and Chief Medical Advisor to the UK Government, was made a fellow this year. We'll hear an extract from the seminar she gave as a new fellow shortly, but first we caught up with the scientists at our antimicrobial resistance discussion meeting, which Dame Sally also spoke at. We chatted with Dr. Julian Parkhill, FRS, and Professor Jodie Lindsay. Dr. Parkhill talked about how bacteria evolve in response to antibiotics, and Professor Lindsay told us about how scientists from different fields are working together to help us tackle challenges in this area.
My name's Julian Parkhill. I work at the Sanger Institute in Cambridge, and I've been speaking at the meeting here on antimicrobial resistance.
And can you tell us what you were speaking about?
So my work is primarily in bacterial genomics. I'm interested in looking at the genomes of large numbers of bacteria to try and understand their relationships, to look at how they evolve and how they transmit. So what I was discussing was how we can see at very high resolution now how bacteria evolve in response to antibiotics. We can identify antibiotic resistance markers within the genomes, and I was talking about how we should be able to use those to predict antibiotic resistance in clinical microbiology.
Can you tell us a bit about your experience of the discussion meeting generally and what some of the highlights for you?
It's been a really broad meeting. It's gone everywhere from policy to research, obviously, to industry, talking about development of new antibiotics, the policy drivers in terms of antimicrobial resistance. So it's been a very broad meeting, really interesting.
My name is Jodie Lindsay, and I'm a professor of microbial pathogenesis at St George's, the University of London, which is a big hospital and medical school combined. And so I'm here because I work on antimicrobial resistance, particularly in Staph aureus and MRSA. And this is a cross-disciplinary meeting. It's bringing together a range of people that work on the area. And I think we actually need more meetings of this kind to actually make sure that everybody understands all of the issues. So I think it's been pretty successful. I think we need to learn a lot more about the new initiatives that are coming just at the moment while we have the public's attention on AMR. And it's been a really interesting event. I think bringing together lots of people that don't necessarily talk to each other and making people see other people's viewpoints, I think, is really important. I think we've got some really big, challenging issues, and not everybody grasps all of them. So to have a bit of an introduction to all of the different aspects is really important. So an example yesterday, perhaps, was there was some discussion about antimicrobial prescribing and how we collect data about that and the difficulty in collecting that sort of data. And I think a lot of people didn't really realise what a problem that was for the research going forward. So that sort of thing, I think, is really helpful.
Dame Sally Davis spoke on New Fellows Day about making science work in the government. She spoke about her various roles providing advice to the government, including her role as Chief Medical Officer, which provides independent advice and writes annual reports which highlight key issues for the government to focus on. She explained how she's broken new ground with these reports by inviting expert academic colleagues to author chapters and advise on the policy implications, and by using modern data visualisation, such as infographics, to reach out to non-specialist audiences. Here's an excerpt from the speech she gave at the Royal Society, where she highlights one area covered in her 2013 report and the impact it's had so far.
But the one I want to finish on is the first deep dive I did, which was on infection. And I thought that infection was great to do. Community to hospital, everyone involved, non-contentious. Until I got all these clinical microbiologists, infectious diseases experts in the room, and what came through was antimicrobial resistance. And indeed, we've modelled it, and we get at least 5,000 deaths a year from E. coli antibiotic resistance. And it was clear that my colleagues had not found a voice to do anything about this. So I felt I had to do something about this, not only in this country, but internationally. So with some colleagues, I wrote the book, The Drugs Don't Work. There's even a TED Talk for those who want to get the quick version. We took to the World Health Assembly a resolution that they must develop, WHO must develop a global action plan with the other UN agencies. What was different about this from previous ones? I got the Foreign Office to do the diplomacy. So 65 countries signed up to it before it even got to the floor of the WHO. I've spoken about it to the G7 science ministers, the Carnegie Group. The government, after my publication last March, withdrew from, they were about to put out their UK strategy for antimicrobial resistance. They withdrew it for 6 months, beefed it up and improved it. Those of you who are in Britain will know that AMR and a rapid diagnostic is the subject that the public voted for the Longitude Prize. Some of you will have noticed that last week we got the Prime Minister, and he mugged it up, he learnt his subject, to announce, having discussed it with the G7 heads of state, an independent commission of the R&D pipeline with the former chief economist of Goldman Sachs, Jim O'Neill. And I make no secret of the fact that where I'm aiming is a day at the UN in 2016 and an international treaty on AMR. So that's the sort of advocacy around science that I am playing out. And I want to say thank you to the scientists, my team who make a lot of this happen, but actually to the politicians who, if you I go about it the right way, do listen to me and have, to date, followed my advice. And I can't ask for more than what the Prime Minister's doing on AMR and everything else. Thank you very much.
Another new fellow this year is Michael Benton, Professor of Vertebrate Paleontology in the School of Earth Sciences at Bristol University. He spoke about how scientists can find out about long extinct species. Here he asks, how do we know how fast T-Rex could run? Could T-Rex bite a car in half? And last, but certainly not least, how do we know that some dinosaurs were ginger?
How do we know the colour of a Tyrannosaurus or the nature of its eyeball? Could we ever know those things? Of course, the first thing that would come to mind is that when we're trying to interpret life of the past, we will use our knowledge of life of the present. In other words, modern analogues as a means of trying to interpret life of the past. So, interpreting the speed that dinosaurs could run. One method is to use footprints. And of course, the spacing of those prints is proportional to the speed of movement. And this simple formula was presented by McNeil Alexander from the University of Leeds a number of years ago. And it represents the velocity based upon gravity, stride length, and the height of the hip. And it will give you the speed that the dinosaur or anything else was traveling. So his formula was not based on a numerical derivation. It's an empirical formula, cross-tested again and again on ostriches, elephants, human beings, rats. It always works. Can't explain why, but it always works for quadrupeds and bipeds. Therefore, we believe we could apply it to an ancient form of life as well. There's an alternative way, completely separate from the footprint approach. And this was work done by John Hutchinson at the Royal Vet School north of London. And he speculated on T-Rex. If this was a sprinter, if it could run really fast, what would be the volume of the major leg muscles that were needed to power that speed of locomotion? Because we can estimate the body mass, 5 or 6 tons. We can look at the way this works in a chicken and the amount of leg muscle that is needed to power a certain speed of movement. And then he calculated, of course, that shape of T-Rex wouldn't work. Because if you work out the volume of leg muscle needed on one side or on both sides, it turns out that at a body mass of 6 tons, the 6,000 kilogram chicken at the top there, 200% of the body weight of T-Rex would have to be devoted to those leg muscles alone, which is clearly impossible. And so he used a different kind of reductio ad absurdum to calculate that T-Rex could not sprint, could not run fast. What about biting? We want to know, could T-Rex bite a car in half? We've seen the pictures, and so whether we believe those pictures or not, of course, is another question. But how can you calculate something such as bite force? Well, here's one way. This bone here is a part of the pelvis of a herbivorous dinosaur. It's got various sharp cut marks in it, and a paleontologist called Greg Erickson speculated that made by the teeth of a T-Rex. So he filled these cut marks with casting medium, pulled them out, and indeed the shape of the hole was exactly the shape of a T-Rex tooth. So that was a reasonable assumption that a T-Rex had sunk its teeth into the bone. Immediately, any physicist here would think, well, now we can calculate the force necessary to puncture bone to that depth using a tooth. And indeed, Erickson did the experiments, and he worked out that it took a bite force of 13,000 newtons to push a tooth that deep into a piece of bone. So that was one rather simple approach. That's sort of schoolboy physics, if you like, or very simple mechanics. Another approach is, and many more and more paleontologists are using these 3D computer visualizations. You can scan your fossil, you make a 3D model that can then be given the material properties of actual bone, not fossil bone, not steel, not anything else. And then you can apply various forces, calculate muscle vectors and strengths. And these actually gave higher potential bite forces for T-Rex of up to 57,000 newtons. So I think the strongest bite of any living animal is the great white shark. So at least if the logic of these calculations is correct, that suggests that T-Rex indeed had a much stronger bite force than any living animal. And of course, we at 200 to 700 newtons should hang our heads in shame. What can we learn from exceptional fossils? Here is a very famous fossil from China. This is called Sinosauropteryx. It's a theropod dinosaur. What interested people was that there was this fluff of bristly structures down the back of the neck and the torso, and then in the tail region, the tail is kind of contorted upwards, were tufts or stripes of different tones. When we put feathers of this creature under the scanning electron microscope, this is what we saw. They're packed with spherical structures about half a micron in diameter. And these we interpreted as pheomelanosomes. These are a particular type of melanin-bearing organelle or capsule within the keratin of the feather. And if this interpretation is correct, they indicate ginger color in that dinosaur. So how can we make that inference? We took this obliging zebrafinch and pulled a few feathers out. And you can see it's got a variety of colors, ginger, gray, black. All of these are melanin-based colors. And it's this relationship between the protein and the melanosome that is fixed. And it's not just fixed in birds, it's also fixed between birds and mammals. So using the extant phylogenetic bracket, birds here, mammals here, fixed relationship between the particular protein and hence the color that it gives. Therefore, we believe we can use this for a direct inference from knowledge of the living forms to this extinct form. And hence we were able to argue in 2010 we've identified the color.
If Professor Benton's talk has inspired you to learn more about how scientists explore the lives of dinosaurs, then don't miss next month's podcast, where we'll be featuring clips from our Summer Science exhibition, including an exhibit about a clumsy Gorgosaurus which lived more than 70 million years ago. Scientists from Manchester University have used synchrotron imaging to reveal that she suffered broken legs and possibly even a brain tumour in her lifetime.
But now, from dinosaurs to education. Back on the 26th of June, the Society launched its vision for science and mathematics education in the UK over the next 20 years. The report outlines the Society's ambitions for how science and maths education should enable people to make informed choices, empower them to shape scientific and technological developments, and equip them to work in an advanced economy. We caught up with Dame Alison Peacock, head teacher at the Wroxham School in Hertfordshire and member of the project's expert working group, to find out more about the report's conclusions and recommendations.
What we know at the moment is that more than ever we need young people leaving school and university able to embrace a new future in terms of technology. There are so many big questions that our planet needs to embrace in terms of population, climate change, the growing technology. There are so many things that we know that we need young people to maintain their sense of curiosity, the desire to find out, and the means to actually extend their knowledge. And so the Royal Society has a vision for 20 years in which one would hope by the time that vision is achieved that the business of understanding and inquiring and finding out and knowing is something that is everybody's business, that we are all engaged in that as a society, and that our children in school and our teachers in school feel hugely supported, that they know that to gain knowledge in these areas is both fulfilling but also offers wide opportunities for their futures, that actually it maintains and enables our country to maintain a very high ranking in terms of our contribution to the field of scientific inquiry, debate, knowledge finding. All of these things are crucial. If we don't act now, we risk losing that status, and that would be terrible. It's also, of course, about maintaining creativity and the capacity to ask questions. Currently, our education system, due to the extreme accountability measures that we have, can, in fact, perversely shut down questioning, shut down inquiry in the name of pursuit of what you can do in an exam that's related to what you can write down in how many minutes you've got in a test. And part of what we've done as a vision committee is to really celebrate the high quality that comes from having space to think and space to ask and space to question and to play with ideas. And you only get that confidence about playing with ideas when you're in an environment where actually it's not about right and wrong answers. It's about investigating and keeping that tenacity, about keeping on saying, well, what else can we find out, and how do we know, and why is this happening, and why does this buck the trend, and what's this pattern? And you know, we need our young people to keep asking those questions and ask them even more than they are now, and an education system that facilitates and supports that.
So is that something that you see as a primary school head teacher, starting at a primary age, that sort of investigating and that sort of way of learning about science?
I think within early years and primary education, our excellent schools, and there are many, many excellent schools in this country, but within excellent primary education, the whole culture of the school is about the art of the possible. Who knows what might happen if we do this, if we work together to try this. And areas of the curriculum, such as mathematics and science, when they are taught in that way, open up so much possibility to children, and there's so much. You know, anybody who's talked to a young child who constantly hears them asking, well, why does this happen, and why does this happen, and what about this, and what about that? You know, they know that young children are born curious and desperate to find out. And the best education within our schools not only sustains that curiosity, it builds upon it, because the children engage with new knowledge, and the culture is one of not, this is what's on my teaching plan, this is what we're going to do today, but this is what we're trying to find out, and who can think about the questions that we might want to explore, and what do we know already, and how can we challenge ourselves to find out new things. And you know, where schools work really, really well, they not only look inward, they look outward, so they engage with other specialists. For example, in our school, just yesterday our children in year six went to visit the Royal Veterinary College, and there they've been finding out all sorts of things, which brings their theoretical science to life in practice. The children are very, very excited about that. So it's constantly about authenticity, first-hand experience, keeping those questions coming. I think we do that very well in primary education. We do it very well in secondary education when we don't allow ourselves to be driven too much by the demands of tests. But young people themselves very soon start saying, why are we doing this? Is it in the exam? And as soon as you get that kind of culture of don't waste our time because we just need to pass the test. Well, of course we want the children to do well in qualifications, but the art is to make the qualifications better in order that what they're seeking to teach and the assessment means that are used keep that level of inquiry going instead of dampening it down.
That's all for this month. Join us in August for a summer science special.